Hello, and welcome to Safari Conversations, the Singita podcast. Even though we've been around for 30 years, we're relatively new to podcasting. But we are storytellers by nature, and we've got so much to share with you. Alongside our conservation partners, we've been busy exploring and protecting Africa's wilderness. So join us as we unpack inspiring, fun, and sometimes crazy stories where you'll meet our incredible people and learn all about the special places in Africa that we call home. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes.
My name is Ross Cooper. I'm the resident photographer
for Singita.
Today's guest is Grant Telfer, head of guide training at Singita Grameeda Reserve, located in Tanzania. Grant first started his career at Singita as a field guide in the South African regions, and thereafter Grant's compass pointed him north to the Singita Grameeda Reserve, where he and his wife managed the Singita Mara River tented camp in the heart of Lamai region. Grant found the opportunity to share his field knowledge and guest experiences to the guiding team. In today's episode, A Journey of Discovery, we're going to be discussing the success of being the first field guide trainer in the Grameeda region. Welcome, Grant.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Russ.
I think there's a great story, and I think there must be a really good journey as to how you landed the role as head trainer here at Grameeda Reserve.
Yeah, it's been fun. I started guiding in 2005 in the Sabi Sands, and then spent time in about 2010, 11, 12 at Singita Sabi Sands, and then some chance with Lubombo as well. And then 2013, I had an opportunity to come up to East Africa, to Tanzania, to do, it was just a 6 months at the time, to do some guide training, to try and help on a course that was being run to develop young Tanzanians to become guides in the industry up here. And that was 2013. So 10 years later, still up here, still really, really enjoying the guide training, have had the opportunity to work with, I don't know, over 100, 150 different guides, youngsters who have come through, and then also the whole group of senior guides who are existing within the Serengeti and working it around here. It's taken me down to Ruaha and working with the Tanzanian National Park Rangers on walking safari skills, how to use their weapons. Yeah, it's been very rewarding.
Talking at close to 100 odd guides that have passed through your training, if we can just go back a step, in terms of guiding, there's always guests that wonder, what does it take to become a guide here in Africa? And I think from both my experience in the guiding role, and even much the same as you, you've experienced it, where many people ask, what are the criteria to become a guide? And can we do it in a few days and land up in the same role? What is the criteria currently at Grameeda Region?
It's an interesting recruitment process. When we send out an advert that we are looking for guides to join the School of Guiding, we'll get anything up to 100 CVs. In the past, I've had it up to about 400 applications. So there's a huge interest in the industry and amongst people who are living in towns like Arusha, Mungumo, these local towns, people who are from the communities around us. Guiding is respected and it's seen as a good job. It's financially rewarding and they can look after their families. So there's a lot of interest in becoming a guide. What we are looking for in this School of Guiding here is we are looking to provide opportunities to youngsters that wouldn't have had the opportunity. So typically what happens when you're looking for guides, often people will look within the industry and for somebody who's already got 7 or 8 years of experience, and you sort of bring that guide in and he's able to operate pretty quickly once he knows the roads, the area. And because our Singita team is a very stable team, there's a lot of senior guides who are doing a really, really wonderful job. There's a nice band of sort of middle guides who've been on the ground and are really, really finding their rhythm now. We thought it would be a nice opportunity to bring in youngsters and use the structure in the team to develop those youngsters. So already we've had sort of six of them go through the School of Guiding and are now full-time guiding in our team. We've got a focus now on ladies. And so the last recruitment had 2 out of the 3 were ladies. And the next one will also be an opportunity for ladies. So you've got this nice project, a nice way to bring youngsters in and give them those opportunities they don't really have. So then how do you choose the right person to come on? I think it's so much of it is in the recruitment. If we get the right people on the bus, that bus will fly. So the initial interviews are done with me and with George, who's the head guide, and Ed, who's the assistant head guide. And we might go to Arusha. We've developed relationships with some of the birding clubs and the nature clubs that are in and around Arusha and some of the local villages, trying to support those places where young people on their own have gone to join like-minded young people to learn, for example, about birds. And they have no opportunity. They don't come from families that have vehicles. They're very limited in the opportunities they've had, but they are inside that group. There are some real gems. And so we spend time with them. We look really hard and spend time with them focusing on communication skills. Are they able to understand us when we talk with them? Can they articulate what they are thinking? You know, do they, when they're talking, the body language and the confidence, all of those have a role. And so we look at those communication skills. We look at that sort of interest that they have. And then we also would obviously take into consideration the fact that they need to have a Class C driver's license, which is to drive a commercial vehicle in this country by law. And if we find the right sort of people, then we bring them on board. They have an opportunity to spend time with us. And if it's working, that just keeps going. And in the initial first few months, it's almost like a probation, and it's a chance for them to see if they fit in with us and if we see the potential in them. To be honest, every single one that we've brought on has stayed and has really been able to grow. And then once they're on the ground here and spending time with us, we've got quite a structured course. They do some learning with us, which we can chat about later. They gain experience during busy season. And, you know, a year to 18 months, you've got a pretty phenomenal, energetic young person who can provide a world-class guided experience. So,
I think that there is great opportunities in bringing in the younger generation and mm-hmm. starting it up. And through the guides that I've interacted with now, many of them actually came from this birding club, which I believe was started by one of the guides that currently work here. I think it was amazing to hear because I actually was guided by him last year. And he had alluded to the fact that he started this birding club. And so far I've been exposed to some of the newer guides that are coming in the ranks now. And they too were associated to that bird club. Given the aspect of, I mean, there's a mammoth task to learn this ecosystem back to front and have a true understanding from it. Once you've got a person in that position, they're super coachable and they're keen to get out there. Where do you sort of start from there?
So it's split two ways. There's obviously the knowledge that somebody needs to gain, which is an expectation out here. And a large part of that falls on the shoulders of the actual trainees themselves. They're given all the resources. They're given the access to us. We work with them in the classroom. But what we're trying to do is to develop an interest in them. And it doesn't all have to be the same. Some guys are good at birds. Some are good at botany. Some are really fantastic at watching animals and animal behavior and tracks and signs. And so you help them to find what they're interested in and then teach them the skills to be able to learn, give them access to the resources to learn. You'll see very quickly if somebody is learning and they're interested and they're active, it comes through on their game drives and when you're with them in the bush, as opposed to someone who sort of hasn't put the effort in. And then a huge focus of mine is teaching them what we call like guiding techniques. It's imagine if you are a carpenter and you've got a little bag and in that bag you've got your different tools and you use those different tools at different times to achieve your end project or something. And so you teach the guides how in different situations and throughout like the course of the work that they're doing, there's different things that they need to be focusing on that can enhance the guided experience. And so we work with those. And I mean, the very beginning and the biggest one is communication skills. So being able to communicate clearly, being able to drive a vehicle and turn and communicate backwards to guests, being able to drive, listen to the radio, talk to guests, look for animals. And that in itself, if you think from someone who probably hasn't grown up in a home with cars, it's quite a lot to already take on. And so it's coaching through that, building the confidence, building trust that what you are doing is going to help them. Because we all expect these incredible guides at the end of it, but we fail to remember that some of them have never had a guided experience in their whole lives.
I think there's a lot to be taken there. And there's so many elements to a fulfilling guiding experience and also just to enhance a guest experience. Out here in the Grameti region, I mean, this area is so vast. What are the experiences that guides would offer to guests being out in this area?
So obviously, yeah, we're lucky. 350,000 acres of, you know, pristine wildlife and land. And there's naturally going to be a focus, people coming out that's on safari. So there's the game drives. Every set of guests that comes here comes with different experiences, different interests. Some have been on one safari, some have been on 20, 30 safaris across Africa. So first thing is teaching the guides and working with the whole guiding team on how to personalize each guest experience. And that, you know, getting the most out of it for those guests. Then walking safaris. So some of the senior guides in the team have done a lot of training and a lot of personal effort put into becoming walking guides, and they can take guests on exercise walks or more of a nature walk or exploring around some trees and, you know, the thicker areas along the rivers, taking your shoes off and walking in the actual Grameti River when it's nice and shallow. So there's those sorts of things. There's opportunities, and we encourage it off that vehicle and exploring and tracks and signs. You know, just getting away from that vehicle a little bit and immersing yourself in the bush. Singita's got a really nice wellness program that's focuses on the guest experience and, in fact, the staff experience and how we, you know, get the most out of it, but in a healthy way.
The more we focus on our wellness opportunities, when you talk about 350,000 hectares, it feels like a playground of wilderness, and there's so much to do and explore out there. And looking at bringing in guides in from communities that literally have areas that are wilderness in their backyards, really, there, I'm sure that there must be some really heartwarming stories of how guides have wanted to be a guide, share their love and the passion for the natural environment. Any of them sort of stand out in terms of where they've come from to what they've achieved in the time that they've worked at Singita?
Yeah, it's massive. It'd be quite nice if you're taking sort of like photographs along the way and you just see where that person came from and where they are now. The big changes is always just in the confidence and the way they hold themselves, the pride in what they've achieved, the fact that they can really support their families now. You know, they really become the breadwinners and looking after the family, putting them through school. So you see there's a spark or twinkle in the eye when they're doing that. Yeah, we've had guys who have come literally from growing up herding cattle and goats as little boys, and some of them arrived and they weren't yet ready for guides, you know, to work on their English and communication skills, and they've started as scullers in the kitchen or a security guard, night security guards. But they've all had an interest in the bush. And what's really nice is once they learn how to guide and be able to share what they know, they're phenomenal on a guided experience because they've grown up in the bush. Their eyes are so much sharper. They interpret animal behavior so much better, you know, than someone who's grown up in the city. They're really interesting, and they see the small things and small details that makes a safari really interesting. They're confident to go and explore areas where no one else is because they trust that they can find whatever is out there or at least make it interesting for their guests. So yeah, you watch those guys start off nervous and then build the trust, and then to, you know, it takes a good 18 months to 2 years from qualifying to actually being comfortable with your guiding, with the area, the roads, the secret places to look for animals, having been stuck a couple of times.
When you say stuck, it's inevitable that guides will find themselves at one point or another. I usually call it temporary mobile, that you're stuck in the mud, that you are going to get yourself out as best as possible before calling one of your colleagues to help you out. But that's just part and parcel of the experience from a guiding standpoint.
And you know, you don't panic when you get stuck. All of those sorts of things, when the radios don't work, being able to still operate and pull off a, you know, world-class experience, all of those sorts of things. So at 2 years, that's when they really start to shine. And it's nice. We speak a common language. We talk about the different guiding techniques if we need to, when we review guest feedback, both positive and stuff that we can work on. And the guys are, yeah, they feedback fit. They respond well.
I suppose much the same as us. We've had the years of experience behind us. And if you took photographs of us when we started to where we are now, you start to see the gray coming through.
That would be so fast.
But I think that's still part of it. I mean, that's part of experience. I think experience is probably the key to success in this field. The more you expose yourself to the various regions, the more you expose yourself to the various aspects within the ecosystem, from astrology to birds to botany, you suddenly become far more experienced. Looking at what we came from in South Africa, where both of us were guides there, why don't they have trackers in this area?
There's a couple of reasons. Remember, South Africa, the bush tends to be a little bit thicker. You know, we're blessed to have huge open areas and the ability to be able to stop and scan with binoculars. So, you know, South Africa, you're really focused on picking up at where a leopard has crossed the road, because that might be what you build your whole game drive around. And having a tracker to help you in those instances is huge. Out here, it's a little bit different. We've got far more space and bigger, more open areas. Guys will stop. They'll scan with binoculars a lot more. The terrain is a little bit more difficult for tracking. You get patches that are a little bit sandy, but for the most part, it's actually quite tricky. And the grass is so thick. Once animals step off that road, it's huge blocks. And so, you know, we've also found that the team really thrives as is. They enjoy getting out there. They enjoy the challenge of looking for the animals, and they have a lot of success too.
I think when looking through binoculars, as you mentioned, Grant, sitting on a vehicle in this expansive landscape, you definitely hone in your skill with that pair of binoculars, and you're able to pinpoint various species and not just the obvious ones sticking out. You're suddenly looking for those lions where their heads or their ears are just poking out the grass, or a leopard, just a tail draped over a branch up in a really thick albizia tree. And so it also allows you to start focusing on the smaller aspects, and not necessarily from the getting off the vehicle smaller aspects, using those binoculars so effectively that you start looking at the eyes, you know, the tail, the hair of an elephant on the back of his tail, looking at the detail. But I do think that scanning with a pair of binoculars is a whole different experience for guests out here.
Yeah, we're fortunate. There's some of these little like hills that we've got that jut out of the plains, and you go and you sit up there, and just sitting there for 20 minutes, 40 minutes or so, and you scan and you pick up animals in the distance close. Guides doing that have often found cheetah, pangolin like that. You spot the lions off at a distance and they're busy stalking a herd of buffalo. So from that angle, it's great. But also just that there's not many places where you have the landscape and the size that we have.
Yeah, the abundance.
That is full with big animals.
It's definitely the abundance of, you know, as the migration is just slowly shifting through at the moment, it's looking through the binoculars and just seeing hundreds upon thousands of white-bearded wildebeest and then zebras amongst them, and looking to the outskirts of where wildebeest are staring at something, or a herd of giraffe are staring at something. It's the magnitude of wildlife when you look at it from such a big scale allows you to just kind of really hone into those. I can't get over that you said you could look with your binoculars and find a pangolin. I think that's having every guide in any thick bushed area down in South Africa want to come up here and start.
Yeah, one of the guys, Charles, in fact, spotted two pangolins moving around. And it's this sort of time of the year when we've got a little bit of the rains, the grass is short, you know.
Yeah.
The wildebeest are coming back on the reruns.
Yeah.
And if you go in there and you turn the car off and stop for a moment, yeah, especially at dusk, you could find anything. Honey badgers sometimes. The other day we saw a porcupine coming out with the sort of the sunset behind them. And you can see at a distance with your binos, but that like orange glow through their quills. You know, they're memorable. And when you have spent a lot of time and been on many safaris and you become interested in the smaller things and appreciate the fleeting glimpses you'd get of those guys, this October, November time of the year is brilliant for that. It really is one of the best times of the year to be up here.
Yeah. From a guest experience, you know, just being on a vehicle and your first day, you sort of feeling what it's like and seeing what it's like and understanding how wildlife is found. And within your third or fourth day, you suddenly feel like an experienced guide at the back there just shouting, lion to your right, there's a leopard back there.
Yeah.
And you just feel that you've immersed yourself so well into the environment just because of having a pair of binoculars in your hand and yeah. honing in your skills, much like those guides. And I guess sharing that love for getting out there. I see it often with guests waking up in the morning, can't wait to get their cup of coffee in their hand and chatting to their guide and already kind of working out a plan of what they want to head out and find, you know, for that particular day.
Part of that now in guide training is sharing that with your guests so that your guests are involved in looking in the right places with you. The different clues from different time of the day, different habitat, different temperatures, you know, the years and months and things. All of that has a little part in it. So as a guest coming on safari with our guides, we really focus on the interpretation and steer far away from a university lecture on gestation periods and all of that sort of thing. I think a lot of our guests leave and they really feel a lot more connected as opposed to those, you know, big five racing safari type experiences where you get to see things, but you don't get to experience it. You don't get to sit and watch and take time, which we are very fortunate to be able to do on this, you know, on the private concession.
What is the most difficult part about being a guide in training? You cannot wait to get them out there and share your experience with people. I think that's the key thing. But what would you say is sort of the challenging aspect for guides that are in training now?
Initially, it's mastering that driving and communicating. I mean, it's as a guide trainer and you're in the back of the car and it's weaving all over the road. Trainees trying to be able to, you know, transfer that information that, you know, what they're thinking and on the move, because the distances out here are big. So guides have to be able to talk and drive.
So just going back where you mentioned that prerequisite to become a guide, they require a C-class certification on driving. For many of the listeners to have a better understanding in terms of these vehicles that are used out here, they are land cruisers, which I'd say a couple of tons with the rig on the back, but they're a stick shift vehicle. So having that, you know, working out your clutch, your low range, high range ratios, maneuverability within mud, soft sand, thick vegetation, there definitely is a skill set that is far beyond just driving around the streets of the city.
And you've got guests on the back who don't want to get bounced through the roof. So a big responsibility. So that takes a little bit of time and a bit of coaching and things. And then once they've mastered the vehicles and they're super solid and comfortable and safe in those vehicles, then we start to move through the guiding techniques. In essence, we talk about, you know, guiding being a little bit similar to producing a meal. You can either give somebody potato and meat, you know, as that's their guided experience. And yes, they will be full and they'll walk out of your little restaurant and they'll be content. But would they come back? Unlikely, you know. And this is where we teach them these guiding techniques. We talk about the pili pili or the chili, the salts, the spices that you can add to that meal so that it just tastes a little bit better. And those are the guiding techniques that we work with. And everyone adapts to it at different speeds and finds some easier than others. And some will progress way faster and they just catch on to it all and they're able to mix it in. And some guides will really take a little bit longer to get it. There's a really high standard that's set. So if someone is meeting that standard and showing, you know, that they're ready to progress to whatever their next level is, wonderful. Like if somebody is struggling, then we won't put the pressure on them because we've also got a commitment to producing the best, you know, the best guided experiences out here.
And I think there's key differences to the various Singida regions where guests that would visit Singida Sabisand would have a completely different experience to what a guest would have in the Singida Grometi Reserve. Not only from a game viewing perspective, but from the interacting that you have with your guide and tracker in South Africa to a guided experience in the Grometi Reserve. And as you said, with 350,000 hectares, drives are longer. They have to spend more time in that vehicle. There's more interpretive skills. There's more animal behavior being explained at the time that you have your guests on your vehicle. As potential candidates may be listening to this podcast, do you have any words of wisdom for new guides or new recruits that are wanting to come and work at Singida?
You know, in terms of what skills should they be working on if they can, they're naturally the more competent they are with their driving skills. That's, you know, that's number one. That's the guide's office. Being able to communicate, especially in English, because that is sort of the common language that we use with international guests when they come on safari. So you really need to be able to understand it, as well as to be able to express what you're thinking.
You mentioned English as sort of one of the prerequisites to guides working in this area. In the time that I've been exposed to a number of guides and having conversations, it's not just English. There's a number of guides here that have learnt other languages.
Mm, it's important. It's, you know, when we're talking about back to the recruitment process, a guide who is able to speak a foreign language is certainly a very important person in the whole guiding industry. And so within our team alone, we've got a few guides who can speak foreign languages. We've got Spanish. One or two are pretty competent with French. We've got staff in the greater team that are competent with Italian and German, even Chinese, Mandarin. So we actively try to recruit people who can help us to bridge with our language barriers because it's important. And being able to just, you know, help them to experience the bush in their own language makes a world of a difference. So
even for you, I mean, speak Swahili. You know, this is
I'm learning. I'm still work in progress, but I do enjoy it. Yeah, and it's nice to make the effort, and it helps with connecting. And this is all about people and connecting with them.
I think that's it exactly. It's, you know, we look at working in the other region. I always look at the comparison. Is that how guide and tracker relationships are so important, and they end up speaking the local language and introducing guests to the local language. And it's definitely integrates you into their culture and understanding their culture more because of the translating of words. You know, I was saying to Alex, who's a trainee guide, the other day that we sort of refer to home as Kaya, and Swahili, they very much use the same word. So it's nice to have that sort of connection. And I think it's important. And what's also quite incredible is that over the period of time, I've learned that a number of the guides that learned those different languages you were talking about, they learned them within 2 years of just going to a school in Arusha, which is
applying themselves, working hard at it. So, you know, obviously, like when these guys do guide, for example, Spanish guests, and I have the opportunity to interact with those guests, you ask for feedback. We actively want to see how we can get better. And these guides are really talented. They can communicate really well in it. But yeah, they're wonderful guides to have in the team.
I think once you apply yourself, success is literally the path that follows.
Yeah, yeah. You know, beyond that, we can, if it's the right person, we can teach them. If they've got a passion, they would already naturally have a passion in the bush. So you would imagine they already have some bird books and they've been, you know, learning some birds, learning some mammals. They've been putting effort into developing themselves. And so when we find those people, those are the ones that we bring into the school of guiding. If you already are a guide and you're out there, you know, the big things to remember again is, we're in a business that's about people. We're leaving guests with memories. You're part of that. You're an ambassador for Tanzania, for the bush, for the safari experience. And you know, if you can just remember your part in it, in being sensitive with wildlife and the way that you move your vehicle around them, the way you look after your guests. And if, you know, if you leave them with good memories and they return and they say they want to return, then you know, you're doing a good job.
I think that is definitely it, is having guests return to the destination and more people looking for experiences. That's ultimately, you know, it's no longer the talk of a vacation or a holiday. It's actually people seeking out experiences. And I think the nice thing with Singida is that you know what you're getting. No matter where you are, whichever region you travel to, you know that you're getting that level of expertise. So I think that you have a pinnacle role here at Singida, and I appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us. It's great that you've impaired that to a number of guides here. And before I let you go, I'm going to ask you one more question. In the time you've been here, in this incredible reserve, this ecosystem that has the migration shifting back and forth twice a year, what's the most amazing sighting you've seen?
Yeesh, Roscoe. You know, those are the tough ones. I think some of the most memorable, I've been blessed with a lot, but some of the most memorable ones are certainly always on foot. There's always that, it just etched into your memory a little bit clearer. I remember one time George, who is the head guide, and myself were walking off Sasakwa Hill down a little game trail. Just as we reached the bottom of the game trail, we bumped into two honey badgers coming up the same trail. And they were like a couple of feet away, and you know, honey badger is notorious for being, you know, for standing up for themselves, not backing down. And within split seconds of seeing them, both George and I grab our family jewels and start backing off right out of there. So that was quite memorable. But I think just what I certainly will always remember about the Serengeti is the big herds of zebra. For me in particular, when you see thousands together, and it honestly is dazzling with all the stripes, that diamond on their forehead, and they're moving together. When they run, that stampeding of hooves. And then wildebeest herds, after crossing the Mara River, when they are exiting and moving away, they're silver and shine. Always feels a little bit like that must have been what it was like to see the sort of Romans approaching you in the olden days with their shields up, massive columns tied together. So, it's those big masses of animals is what the Serengeti is most memorable for.
I think not just the sightings, but if you think of a sensory side of things, it's the sound here that seems to amplify.
Yeah.
And particularly during the migration, when you talk about the white-bearded wildebeest, it's just a sound that continually echoes throughout the night of them bleating back and forth.
Tented camps are where you want to be when it's like that. Mara River tented camp endlessly has wildebeest around it when it's in full season. And at nighttime, you hear the hyenas and lions sort of moving through camp. And then you're in your tents up under the deck, so you're safe, but you hear the hooves just thundering past. It's incredible. Sabora can be the same sort of experience.
Yeah, explore really, much
really,
the same.
Really, really special.
The explore tented camps down in the further western section. I've stayed at a couple of those, and I remember a very fun story where we were staying in the camp for one night, and lions started roaring at about 10 o'clock at night, and I sort of nudged my wife and I said, wow, lions, can you hear the lions roaring? There must have been two or three big males roaring. So it's a pretty incredible experience. And as the night progressed, they didn't stop. And about 2-3 in the morning, they just kept roaring. One of the really cool experiences we witnessed yesterday, and I've got to share it with you, is a couple of banded mongoose that surrounded a cheetah. One mongoose went up a tree and the whole business of mongoose that were watching it sort of decided to sort of ambush this cheetah. And the cheetah eventually chased the mongoose and the mongoose ran down the tree. And it's, when I looked at it, I said, Lindsay, my wife, probably the first time I've ever seen that or experienced it. And that sort of solidifies our entire conversation of experience in the bush and how we interpret things, how we explain things and how we share our knowledge. And so I think many guides that are working in this region and many of the other Singida regions are going to draw on a lot of experiences. And I look forward to seeing the guests share that love with the guides out here in the bush.
Yeah.
Now, thanks, Grant. I really appreciate your time and spending it with us today. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in for another episode of the Singida Podcast Safari Conversations. Until next time. Thank you for listening. If you want to follow other episodes of our podcast series, Safari Conversations, please follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from or on our website at singida.com.